there are very few things that aren't just a Google away.
Yeah.
You know, and I think if you have the curiosity and if you want to lean in and learn, there's nothing you can do.
Hello, and welcome to Overshare, a podcast where we have honest conversations with creative people we admire about the struggles that often come along with being a creative professional. Now, in the world of carefully curated portfolio sites and Instagram feeds, we try to get past those highlights and discuss the tough stuff we don't talk about in public often enough. In this episode, you will learn the value of being curious and the importance of appreciating different cultures and people and its effect on your creative perspective. I'm your host, Justin Genak, and I'm also the co-founder of Working Not Working, a curated community that connects companies with the universe's most respected, most awarded, and hardest working creatives in advertising, design, production, and tech. This is the part where I'm supposed to remind you to please subscribe to Overshare if you want to get it when a new episodes are released every 2 weeks. Also, please rate and review us. That's the way people discover the podcast and also helps us get up in the Apple charts. So whether you do it now or after, please give us a rate and review if you enjoyed the episode. So today's episode is my in-studio conversation with Kwame Taylor Hayford, who is the Managing Director of Brand Development at Chobani, as well as co-founder of social activism organization Saturday Morning, and the co-owner of August Market, a lifestyle store in Western New York State that he and his wife started. Kwame has held many roles in advertising over the years, from his early days of being an account executive at TBWA Media Arts Lab, where he was working on Apple, the famous Mac versus PC campaign, to being an integrated producer of various ad agencies around the country, and to his role at Chobani now. So it makes sense that his career is transient since he spent his childhood as the son of a diplomat. He moved every couple of years from New York City to Ghana, to Egypt and South Africa and the UK, and then back to New York to finish high school. Being immersed in so many cultures has given Kwame an appreciation of people and a curiosity to learn something from everyone he meets. We touch on a lot of topics during our conversation, including how one of his proudest moments came on the heels of a career low point, that it's important to define success for yourself and not have it based on what other people think. And after a life spent traveling the world, he's realized we're really all kind of the same. It's a good one, and I hope you enjoy it. So here's my conversation with Kwame Taylor Hayford.
All right, so how are you, man?
Life is good.
Yeah.
You know, I can't complain. It's busy as hell, but I don't think I want it any other way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You said yesterday you were traveling.
Yeah, so yesterday I was in Miami and Houston. It's a very interesting day of visiting lots of different stores, grocery stores, that is.
Uh-huh.
Checking out the dairy aisle, looking at the yogurt shelf, the yogurt set.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just a reality of my world right now, but it's actually really interesting. Like, you pay a lot more attention to the products that are launched and the ingredients in those products.
Uh-huh.
I could speak for days about this, by the way.
Yeah, yeah.
But
we're going to say, this is actually a yogurt talk podcast. This is not, it's not Overshare, it's yogurt talk.
No, yogurt talk?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like it. But anyway, I think working for Chobani has gotten me a lot more aware of what I eat.
Yeah.
And of the impact that the companies that I choose to support with my dollars do in the world. So it's been good.
So it's definitely a perspective shift then.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
For sure. And it's funny because people spend lots of time and effort curating the brands that they wear and sneakers they put on or even the bars they frequent and that sort of thing. But very few people think deeply about what they put in their bodies. And I think that's, you know, interesting.
Yeah, well, it seems like we have you put a lot of time into everything else, and then the thing that actually sustains you is
right.
Like, well, shit, I'm busy. I'm just great. Whatever is there, just hand me that candy bar. Yeah,
exactly. So it's it's interesting.
So I just have a couple quick questions.
Yeah, what's up?
What's your favorite curse word?
Ooh,
it's just a nice warm up.
I don't know if I have a favorite. Yeah. I think I use them all equally.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, that's very democratic that way.
Democratic cursing. All right, Greek or non-Greek yogurt.
Definitely Greek.
Definitely Greek?
Yeah, and this was pre-Chobani too. So.
Yeah, okay.
So.
Yeah, I've never tried, back in the day, but I haven't tried the Chobani non-Greek, so I'm looking forward to that.
You should.
The packaging is so good.
Well, thank you for saying that.
It's gorgeous.
We love it. We think it's incredible. Uh-huh. I think generally people agree.
Yeah. No, I think at least within the industry, it's been really well received.
Yeah, you know, very well received in the industry.
Yeah.
We're excited about that.
That's cool.
Again, we're at a yogurt manufacturer And we've built this creative discipline that is now putting out work that is world-class and that we're very excited to be behind. So for us, it's nice when we can hear that. It's nice when we get recognition in the industry and beyond.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just reassuring that we're on the right track.
Well, like, and with any rebrand in general, there's, like, how long were you guys working on that?
So I think normally rebrands take about a year, year and a half,
right,
depending on the scale of them. We did ours in about 6 months.
Oh, damn.
7 months, maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and,
that,
and that's hard, too, when you're affecting all of the packaging and all the touch points. Like, even just to go and produce and make that stuff, it takes a while to get out.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It really does. But that's part of what I love about Chobani. We move at the speed of light.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're very, very nimble.
And just get things done.
Yes.
Yeah, that's exciting.
It's the only way to live.
Let's go back a little bit of, you know, we've known each other for a while, but I don't really know much about your background. So, like, where are you from originally?
Sure. So, a bit of a complicated story. I was born in New York City, but I grew up mostly overseas.
Okay.
So, in Africa and in Europe, more specifically in Ghana, which is where my family is originally from.
That's cool.
Lived in Egypt, lived in South Africa, lived in the UK, and then did my final year of high school and college in New York and started my career here. So
from what years were you abroad?
From when I was 4 to when I was 15.
And then coming to, well, first of all, like, why were you traveling or moving around so much?
Sure. So my dad's job, my dad worked, he was a diplomat. So he worked for the Foreign Service, and then he worked for the UN. So that took us literally all over the world.
And how long are you in each country typically?
Each country, you know, 2 to 3 years, and we had a couple of repeats in there.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was an incredible way to grow up. Very eye-opening. You learn to appreciate lots of different cultures and people. I definitely miss part of that.
Really?
Yeah. I think there's something nice about not just visiting another culture, but actually living and immersing yourself in it. You just get such a deep understanding for people, and you realize that we're all kind of the same. We love
sure.
the same things. We
live
the for
thing.
The most part. Yeah. For the most part in the same way. So so for me, it was an incredible way to grow up. And, you know, I often joke with my wife that I'd want our kids to grow up that way. She is the exact opposite of me. She
uh-huh.
was born and raised in the exact same house from when she was, you know, a child till 21, basically.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, something about that rich kind of diversity of experience that I think is important, especially in today's world where we're so much more connected.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Was that perspective on, you know, kind of being that transient and moving around, did that come with hindsight, or as a kid, were you like pretty gung ho for it too? Because it's got to be hard. Like, I moved schools a lot. I moved mm-hmm. like schools, I think, like 4 or 5 times, mm-hmm. and being the new kid all the time,
yeah.
not easy.
Being the new kid, not easy. I think what helped it was I have a pretty big family, so I have 3 brothers and a sister.
Okay,
so we kind of moved as a unit, as a crew.
And what's the age difference between your siblings?
The spread, it's about a 10-year spread between okay. all of us. 3 of us are grouped, you know, a little bit older, and then there are 2 that are quite a bit younger. But that made it easy. You okay. know, you kind of had a built-in network, built-in support.
And they're in the school with you,
exactly.
a year or 2 around
exactly.
you. Yeah,
exactly. So that I think that helped a ton.
Yeah, I didn't. Like, my sister was like 5 years younger, so it was never
oh, okay.
like kind of in the same genre.
Yeah,
but
yeah. My older brother is 15 months older, and the brother right after me is 3 years younger.
Yeah.
So
you're all in the same school at least.
Pretty
yeah.
much, yeah.
Do you feel like that made you? I felt like it forced me to be outgoing, and I wonder if that's the case with most kids who move around a lot, or can it go either way? I'm not really sure.
Yeah, it's funny because I'm a massive introvert. Most people would never expect
no,
that.
No,
but
not at all.
But I enjoy spending time by myself away from, you know, people. Don't get me wrong, I also enjoy people.
Yeah,
I'm
yeah.
a very curious person, and I love talking to and understanding people's backgrounds and their experiences, and you just gain a different perspective when you do that. But yeah, I think my upbringing definitely made me more apt to engage,
mm-hmm.
you know, and to lean into people. And I think there's always something that you can learn from another person, be it something that they've said to you or something that they've experienced. Or there's a lot of value in being curious.
And then did you speak a lot of languages growing up because you were moving around?
Yes. So most of the countries we lived in, English was sort of the main language, Ghana included.
Okay.
But I do speak two Ghanaian languages, mostly just with my family and the occasional cab driver from Ghana.
Uh-huh. Yeah, nice.
Yeah.
And then did you grow up in a creative household at all? Like, were your parents creative?
Yes. So my, I think I mentioned before, my dad was a diplomat, but my mom was an architect.
Okay.
And I think a lot of my creative sensibilities come from her.
Yeah.
Both my parents were very into current affairs and culture and music and art. So we were exposed to a lot of that growing up. And I think I'll credit them for keeping us very exposed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and I think also if you're traveling to all these different countries being able to go every couple of years, here's new culture, here's new music, here's new art to be exposed to.
Exactly. Exactly. And I think... So we lived in Egypt. We lived in Cairo and in two, you know, parts of the city, an area called Mahdi and an area called Giza where the pyramids are. And I still remember getting out into the Sahara, you know, going to the pyramids. And then we took trips up to Luxor and Alexandria, which are a bit further north. Unbelievable.
I love how you say Luxor and I just think Vegas.
Yeah.
Jeez. Like, that's how uncultured I am. Oh, shit.
It's a good reference,
yeah.
though.
Yeah. Okay, so the actual Luxor. Yeah. The
actual Luxor.
Uh-huh.
But it was dope. I mean, it's, I wouldn't trade any of those memories for anything.
Yeah. And how was it coming back to New York? And obviously, New York has a ton of culture and all that. Mm-hmm, but coming back to New York is that like end of high school. Middle and high school after being away for so long. Was that a hard transition?
It was definitely different. So we came back to New York from South Africa, and it couldn't have been more different. We moved to South Africa in 97, post-apartheid.
Mm-hmm.
Very interesting time to be there. I mean, to this day, it's probably my favorite place I've ever lived because I was old enough to experience it in a way that I can, you know, still remember.
Yeah.
I made some incredible friends that I'm still in touch with today. And we lived in mostly an expat community, so we're a bit insulated from most of what was happening there. But it's such a beautiful country, amazing people, like just the resilience and the energy and the spirit. But then to come to New York City and then ultimately we settled in upstate New York, well, Westchester, New York, so not proper upstate, but...
Well, I feel like anything over 23rd Street is upstate.
Right, cool. So upstate New York.
Yeah.
It was just suburbia.
Yeah.
You know, white picket fence. It was the stereotypical, you know, sort of suburban community that you'd see on TV.
Yeah.
Bit of culture shock, but the community was pretty open. I think we lived fortunately with a bunch of people who worked in business or in law or who worked in New York City. So they were quite exposed. And I think that helped us acclimate and understand how we could kind of, you know, fit in, quote unquote.
Yeah. That's got to be the culture shock of that. I can't even imagine.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I mean, it was pretty different.
Uh-huh. And then and where'd you end up going? Like, after high school, where'd you go to college?
So I went to college at SUNY Geneseo, which is part of the State University of New York system. People joked back then, I'm not sure if this is still true, that it was the Harvard of the SUNYs.
Oh, nice.
And took a lot of pride in that.
Yeah.
I stumbled upon it because they sent a guidance counselor down to my high school who... met with a bunch of different students, and I remember sitting with her. I forget her name now. I'm actually going to beat myself up about this because she was lovely.
Mm-hmm.
And she described this school to me, and it was in a rural town. The university basically was the whole town.
Okay.
And there, you know, large farms and cow fields and all the stuff that to me coming from South Africa was just sounded completely nuts considering we're, you know, living half an away from the most impressive city in the country. So I took a trip up there. I did like a weekend trip and I just had an incredible experience. I met with really interesting students, most of them from the New York City area who'd gone up there. Ventured out to sort of Letchworth Park, which is not far away from where the school was. And it just felt like a completely different experience.
Mm-hmm.
So I jumped in. I'm like, you know what? Sure. I knew I was going to come back to New York City eventually. I wanted to have a bit of an adventure. And it just seemed like a lovely small town.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what it was. You know, it was an incredible period in my life where I think I got a much better understanding of what the American psyche is all about.
Hmm. After being so removed from it your whole life.
And
then did you have a particular line of interest that you know you wanted to go to school for? Or?
Yes. So, little known story. In high school, here in upstate New York, quote unquote, I was really
seamless at
big
it.
Into computers and into technology.
Okay.
So I started a computer consulting business where I'd work with local...
In high school. Okay.
I'd work with local businesses and with individuals who needed help basically setting up their PCs, you know, back then, and scanners and printers, and I would charge them $20 an hour. And I was busy, I'll put it that way.
Yeah.
I was busy.
Yeah.
So I did quite well. I initially went to Geneseo for computer science with a minor in business. But then I flip-flopped them, basically. Mm-hmm. So I did a major in business and a minor in computer information systems. And when I graduated, my initial thought was to go into finance. So I took a job. I had an internship at UBS, which is big Swiss bank. And honestly, I just did not love it.
Yeah.
Didn't love the work, didn't love the culture. It just didn't appeal to me and to my creative sensibilities. So I took another internship at a small ad agency in Chelsea. I think they're still around, called Agency 212.
Okay.
And I kind of just fell in love. I had an amazing mentor, this woman who I recently got back in touch with. I'm actually very excited about.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, so we're going to grab lunch, I think, next week. But she sort of showed me the ropes. I worked on a bunch of hotel brands and on some entertainment brands. And I fell in love with advertising. I loved that all the creative stuff I loved doing outside of work could help make me better at work.
Yeah.
That
art and culture and music and understanding people. And
exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Super inspired by that and kept going. So shortly after that, I worked for a little known agency back then called VML.
Mm-hmm.
And then got an amazing opportunity to go out to the West Coast. I applied for a job with TBWA, Shia Day, on Apple. I flew out to interview, got the job, which was incredibly exciting to me because I'd never been to LA. I'd never been to the West Coast, really.
Yeah.
Came back 2 weeks later, moved to LA. And that's when the Media Arts Lab building was first opened. So I interviewed at Shiat. I moved out. I was working at Mal in that building. I think there were probably 30 or 40 of us at that time. And it just felt like the most exciting thing in the world.
Yeah. And back then, was there like Mac versus PC and all that stuff?
Exactly. So Mac versus PC, iPod silhouettes, launched the original Apple TV, launched the original iPhone. It was fun.
And back then, you were doing account management?
Or? Yeah. So I was in account service. I was a digital account executive. Back when Facebook was just emerging and MySpace was actually still a thing.
Oh, yeah.
Did a lot of international work. So there's some other social platforms like Mixi and Bebo.
Uh-huh.
It was a really dynamic time and banner ads were everywhere. And, you know, we had a very specific point of view on banner ads at Mal. We weren't, you know, huge fans.
Uh-huh.
But we found other ways to innovate. And custom media partnerships, we did a ton of online content back then. And we started to think about how we could build community around the brand online. And that's really leaning heavily into social media.
Yeah, and that's like pretty early days. It was like
2006?
Yeah, isn't it funny how that seems like the olden days, but it's only 12 years ago.
It's so crazy. I find myself sometimes talking about when Facebook apps were a thing, and I'm like, wow.
Oh, yeah, Facebook apps.
It's old school.
I forgot about those completely. So you went from doing account, mm-hmm. Account services, mm-hmm. and then you went into production?
I did. So after Mal, I worked for Saatchi & Saatchi, at first in L.A.,
mm-hmm.
And that's when my interest in production became real. I mean, I always knew that I wanted to be closer to the creativity and I wanted to spend more time with creative people, more time with production companies, making the output versus, you know, managing it. And so after a few months of working at Saatchi in LA, I moved back to New York and started working at Saatchi in New York. And it's at that point that I made the transition from being in account and got into production.
Yeah. And then you stayed in production for another, 10 years probably, right?
I stayed in production for, a very long time. I loved it, I love that I was able to make stuff.
Yeah.
And I didn't really care what that stuff was. Obviously, my background's very heavily digital, and I was inspired about innovative uses of technology. But I just wanted to make creative ideas. Yeah. So I lucked out. At that time, Tachi New York was going through some evolution and some transformation. So I got opportunities to work across the quote-unquote silos.
Right.
And I got to make some incredible work. I made augmented reality games. I made TV spots. I managed print shoots. I worked on experiential things. I made new products. It was such a dynamic time. And we had great clients that trusted us and that would let us experiment. And for a while, I think it was a truly creative and wonderful place to be.
Yeah. And then you, after that, you went to Anomaly.
Sidley. Yeah. I've done the rounds, my friend. I've done the rounds.
So what was the kind of impetus to go from, agency side to client side? Because, I see that culturally happening a lot more over the past few years, but it is a bit of a jump because you weren't, what's your title now at Chobani?
Yeah. So at Chobani, I'm the managing director of our in-house creative discipline, what we call brand development.
Okay.
And you're right. There's definitely a trend right now, agency people going in-house at brands. Lots of reasons for that, and I'll give you my point of view on it in a second. But for me, having been an agency guy my entire career, I wanted to get a different point of view on the business as I understood it.
Right.
And I think the opportunity at Chobani came up and felt, incredibly inspiring because this company, and I'm not just drinking the Kool-Aid or eating yogurt, is incredible.
Yeah.
It has an amazing founder. It has a mission. It has purpose imbued in it. And it's not a vanity project Chobani to do all the things with its employees, with the community, with its food that it does.
And if people aren't familiar, the founder is Hamdi.
Yeah.
Hamdi. They should see one of his talks. I saw him give a talk at the PSFK conference.
Oh, cool.
Like 4 or 5 years ago. And it was the origin story of Chobani and how he just basically bought the yogurt factory and had no idea what to do with it. And they spent a few months just painting it because that's the only thing he knew. He's like, well, this thing looks terrible. We're just going to paint it.
Yeah.
And we're having conversations. And so if anybody has a chance to go and look that up, it's a really inspiring story, just his thought process of just making something happen.
It's super inspiring, one step at a time. No one knows any more than you. And I think what I love about Hamdi's story is it's the American dream.
Yeah.
He came here from Turkey with not much, found and made his home in upstate New York, had this sort of dream, and had the confidence and had the motivation to act on it and put in a ton of hard work, and is also, massively talented and inspiring. And 10 years later, he's got this incredible company that can do a ton of good in the world.
Yeah. And it's nice when you see an opportunity and then actually have the courage to go after it.
Exactly.
Because I think a lot of times we think about, like, oh, it'd be great to do this, or I should do that, or whatever. But then fear kind of gets in the way of that.
I think fear is something that we all feel, and I think it's something you should actually embrace, but don't let it cripple you.
Yeah.
It's very important that you are able to get over that hump. And, the fear of failure, or what's that Michael Jordan quote? Like, I've, failed over and over and over again, and that's why I succeed.
Uh-huh.
I think it was Michael
something
Jordan.
Like that, yeah.
I can't remember.
Yeah.
But that's important to keep in mind, like it's never going to be perfect. And yes, you might fail, but you've got to be able to go from failure to failure without any loss of enthusiasm and without any loss of the ability to act.
Yeah. I heard someone say that there's no such thing as failure. It's just an expensive lesson learned or an inexpensive lesson learned. And it's a great way to look at it because you just keep, you see people's success stories and they're always built on failures, whatever your definition of failure is.
I actually think the media does a really bad job of helping us understand how successful people got to where they are.
Yeah.
Because most people think that I don't know. Kevin Systrom from Instagram just woke up one day and founded Instagram, and it was all good.
Yeah.
I mean, he had two other businesses that went nowhere before he landed on Instagram.
Yeah.
And I think it was him pushing through those quote unquote failures that helped him understand what the opportunity with Instagram was going to be.
Yeah. And it's just, what did you learn from that? And then you
exactly.
now have a better a guide to navigate certain situations mm-hmm. that you just didn't have that knowledge before. And
exactly.
I think that holds true for your career, and that holds true for relationships.
Totally agree.
It's all of that stuff.
Yeah.
And it's a foundation to build on.
Yeah.
So
for sure.
So you've been at Chobani now. Do you see, like, was the transition hard going from agency side to brand side?
Yeah.
Or was there anything that like really shocked you, or?
I get that question a lot. And I think, for me, it hasn't been that big of a transition, because what we've built with our team is a lot like an agency in the right. way that it looks and feels and operates, even in the way it's structured. So it feels very familiar, and we've created a creative culture at Chobani, excuse me, that's allowing us to make incredible work and build really strong sort of relationships and partnerships with the existing team at the brand.
Yeah. How many people are in the kind of the creative group?
So brand development is now a little over 50 people.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So it's grown significantly since we started. And I keep saying we, Leland Mashmeyer, our chief creative officer,
yeah.
Joined Chobani initially. And I joined him to build this team.
Yeah, that's exciting.
Yeah.
That's really cool. And you have your hand in a lot of different things. So you have that going on. You also are part of Saturday Morning.
Yep.
And you also own a lifestyle store in upstate New York.
Western New York.
So
people get upset when we say upstate New York. It's
yeah.
technically Western New York.
Because, yeah, New York goes up and it goes out.
Exactly.
It goes left.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, I'll start with August Market just because I got a plug for my wife. So we... We started the business Black Friday last year, and it's an incredible story, actually. My wife worked in fashion here in the city for years and years and years, and always had the ambition to have her own business.
Yeah.
And we talked about it on and off, and we were working together to figure out exactly what it could be. And then we just landed on this thought that we're both incredibly into fashion, and we've traveled a bunch, and we're very inspired by products from all around the world that have a bit of a mission, and you're going to get this theme from me a lot, that are kind of doing good, you know, and just being responsible in how they're using material or in how they're treating the environment, but also a very high design sensibility. So we got together, we wrote a business plan, you know, to the point we made it earlier about just doing it.
Yeah.
We did it. We found an amazing space in a town called East Aurora. It's just outside of Buffalo, New York.
That is very far from here.
It is definitely
You guys
far.
Live in New York.
Yes.
And you open a shop, but six hours away?
Man, you've got to go where there's a market opportunity.
Okay.
You know,
smart.
Like Brooklyn does not need another store. New York City does not need another store. But East Aurora... There was nothing like the store we wanted to create, our aesthetic, the products that we were going to carry. None of that existed in and around East Aurora. So we worked together with an incredible team. A good friend of mine who works at Refinery 29 helped us with the branding. We picked the name. It's called August Market. We are also online.
What's the story behind that? The name.
So that was my wife's idea. So apparently in the fashion business, August is when buyers go to market for new products and essentially a fresh point of view on the year ahead. So it felt like a good name for the store. What we've set up is very heavily curated. We buy brands from sort of all over the world. We're focused right now on women's apparel, footwear, and accessories, and we do some home goods. But we have ambitions to launch a men's line, which I'll do the buying for next spring.
Oh, that's cool.
And yeah, it's been great. So we're open 8 months. We launched e-commerce in March, so that's been online a little bit shorter. But it's doing incredibly well. So we're excited.
And how often are you guys going up to East Aurora?
Yeah, so my schedule's a little crazy. We were talking about this earlier. I typically go up either on Thursday or Friday nights, and I come back on Sunday. And I'm there basically every weekend.
Really?
Yeah.
And you're not driving, you're flying up.
No, I'm flying. Okay. 45-minute flight.
Oh, that's easy.
Easy. Yeah.
That's exciting, though.
Yeah, no, so it's good. And it's, you know, it's amazing seeing your partner in a different context. I mean, obviously, when we worked, when she worked in the city, we would both go to our respective jobs and come back home, and you don't really get a ton of insight into what the other person is doing.
Or you hear about it, or exactly. You hear the complaining about it, or you know the venting.
You don't
see them in their element.
You definitely don't, and it's been awesome seeing her in her element, and also seeing her. Be great at something that I know very little about.
Yeah, it gets inspiring. Yeah,
for sure. For sure.
That's cool.
Yeah.
And then you're also part of, you started with Keith and the crew.
So Saturday Morning is an incredible organization that some good friends of mine and I started about 2 years ago now. Mm-hmm. So Keith Cartwright, who's the ECD at 72 and Sunny, Jeff Edwards, who's the ECD at RGA in LA, and Jayanta Jenkins, who's sort of the creative lead at Twitter. And I founded it. And it's, you know, we there was so much negative press in our culture probably 2 or 3 years ago. Things are so polarized. It's really hard to have a constructive conversation on race or gender equality or any of these issues that are quote unquote hot buttons.
Yeah.
So we wanted to create an organization that would help us develop that safe space and also put initiatives into action that can help improve the dialogue on all those issues.
Right.
And Saturday Morning, landed as just an opportunity, and it was founded on this idea that if Sunday's the day when kind of families get together around the table and sort of break bread and talk, then Saturday should be a similar opportunity for us to come together as a culture and discuss and debate and push some of these issues. And it's been an incredible ride. You know, we launched, we had an outpouring of support from a bunch of different brands. And we're actually now working in partnership with Spotify on a big initiative. And we're also working with Procter & Gamble on another big initiative that we're going to launch hopefully later this year.
Yeah, that's great. And I know when I first came across it, you know, there was a lot going on in the world at the time. And you guys have what you put out there, peace briefs.
Yeah.
So what was the idea behind the peace brief and the kind of the hope and the expectation of that?
Sure. So when we launched Saturday Morning, we chose to focus on a few different issues. Mm-hmm. One of those issues was the police in the community, and we wanted to help improve those relationships and better that dynamic. So we had an open call for ideas from our community and universities, individuals, brands, but then we also incubated a few thoughts on our own, and one of those thoughts ultimately became the peace brief. And the peace brief is a garment, it's a piece of clothing that you wear, and it's meant to humanize the interactions between the police and the community. So imagine a pair of boxer briefs with a message printed around the band that helps put things in a slightly different context.
Mm-hmm. So where you'd normally see Calvin Klein.
Exactly.
What does it say instead?
It would say, I'm a father.
Yeah,
you know, like messages to humanize that interaction. So I'm father, you know, please don't shoot. My life matters. From our perspective, there's a unique opportunity to put a different thought or a different idea in the minds of police and individuals in those very tense interactions.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that small reminder that, hey, I know we seem worlds apart, but we actually have a lot more in common than you think.
For sure.
You know, and being able to call out the fact that, hey, I'm a father too.
Yeah.
Like, think about what's going on here before you act. To us, it felt like a very kind of poignant moment and the right opportunity, you know, just based on what we know about the culture, to introduce that message.
Yeah. And I feel like we spent a lot of time pointing out our differences.
Mm-hmm.
And it's something I've thought about for a few years and never really figured out the best way to articulate it or put something into action. But, mm-hmm. I just realized any group we're in, we could find ways to find someone's otherness.
Yep.
And it could shift. You could have a room of 10 people and we could go and find ways to make someone else another. And so like I had an experiment like a year ago. I got out of the subway on 34th Street and 7th Avenue. I said, everyone I pass on this block, I'm going to try to find one thing I have in common with them.
There you go.
And I was like, oh, there was like an elderly woman with fresh kicks on. I was like, oh, she's into sneakers too. Cool. And that guy's bald also. And she has terrible eyesight too, you know. And it was such an interesting experiment. Granted, in New York City, it's like rapid fire, but it was like, it was almost like running on the treadmill trying to find similarities, which was, it felt really good. And I bring this up and I watch it like once a month, Denmark TV2, they did a thing that says, All That We Share.
Oh, and haven't, so they, haven't seen it.
Oh my God, I got to send it to you. And I'll put it in the show notes too so people can check it out. But it's
cool.
One of my favorite things I've ever done. And they basically got maybe, a half a dozen, six, eight groups of people that are very distinct. So like bikers and nurses and teenagers. And they put them in boxes. And then they'd be like, all right, who is the class clown? And those people that were class clowns go to the front and they're all in one group together and they're laughing. Who had sex this week? And then people are giggling and they go together. And you're like, we all have something in common.
Yeah.
We have way more in common than we have different. So I think like those opportunities to humanize people and not go, it's us versus them constantly.
It's funny because I feel the culture today is so polarized and everyone is focused on, to your point, what pulls us apart and what makes us different. But I guarantee if we flipped it and just tried to do essentially what you did, there'd be so much connective tissue, and it's going to overwhelm the few things that are creating fractures in our society today.
Well, that's what I love about sports. I go to a sports arena and I'm like, I know at least half these people don't agree with me politically on most things, but we can all cheer for the Giants or the Red Sox.
Exactly.
And I think even just thinking about most of this strife and us versus them is based on fear. Mm-hmm. And I always think that's an interesting thing. Like we have the fear in common, like especially like on the gun debate.
Yeah.
Some people are afraid that they, they don't want innocent people being killed by guns.
Mm-hmm.
And other people on the other side want to protect themselves and their family.
Yeah.
So they think they need to have guns. But everybody's afraid of, it's like, so we have the same fear. Let's just go and figure, let's even just understand that together. We just all want to be safe.
Yeah.
And it's just, how do you create a dialogue that isn't so so polarizing?
Yeah, and that's bringing it back to Saturday morning. That's our ambition. Let's just create a safe space where people can come and have these debates and discussions. And we don't all have to agree, but I think if we're able to speak constructively about these issues, we're more likely to find a solve or find a way to improve them than if we don't talk about them at all.
Yeah, and I think that's like, it's hopeful and inspiring that you guys have seen brands stepping up and are excited to get involved. Like I just saw the Spotify thing you guys did with Janelle Monáe and Pharrell.
Mm-hmm.
You want to just talk a little bit about what that is?
Sure, and I think brands have an unbelievable ability to influence how we all think and feel. Mm-hmm. Spotify approached us last year to help them design essentially an initiative for Black History Month. And I think... I feel very fortunate that they acknowledged, with us that it is a bit strange that Black History is only celebrated one month out of the year.
And the shortest month.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And the shortest month. So we innovated together a year-long celebration of the achievements of people of color, and we debuted it with an incredible piece by Janelle Monáe on Afrofuturism. And it was really well-received. We just did... the second edition with Pharrell on just the importance of Black women in our culture today, and I think
that's a really powerful perspective.
It was such a powerful perspective from someone who is a very vocal and visible advocate of people of color and of course of Black women. So the content we developed together manifests itself in the Spotify app. There's an actual section in the app called Black History is Happening Now that you can go and sort of, browse. And there's a ton of stuff, around the video pieces that we created. There are playlists and, shorter pieces of content and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But we're excited to continue to work with Spotify to update that platform and continue to put out points of views that help people understand others in a much different perspective.
Yeah. And do you feel like your background of, you know, your childhood and being around other people and being in other cultures, like how much has that affected and influenced like all of this for you?
I think it's been hugely influential. I mean, to be honest, I can't really imagine my life any other way, I guess,
right, of course,
because it's, you know, how I grew up. But to me, the curiosity was the most important thing. And I got a lot of that from my dad. My dad is an incredibly curious person. And he is hugely inspirational to me. I've never seen anyone work harder or be more passionate at anything than my dad. Yeah, he would, you know, go to work early in the morning, come home late at night, and still like work till he went to bed around 1 or 2 a.m., where he'd be flicking through CNN and Fox News because he wanted a balanced perspective on everything.
Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, I find that hugely important, and just be curious and make sure that you're always open to hearing at least a different point of view, because different people come from different contexts and will always have a different perspective, and you can only fully form your own perspective if you have all that input.
Right. Well, and speaking of the importance of different points of view, it's been such a hot topic, or the buzzword of diversity and diversity hiring within the industry, especially in the past few years.
Yep.
Do you feel like the industry as a whole is doing well enough, or is, because sometimes it just seems like it's a buzzword and maybe people aren't taking the action that they're that they're saying, or they're just trying to check some boxes. Yeah. Which seems like nobody wants to be a checked box.
You know, I think it's not an easy issue to solve. But I do feel that I would love to see a lot less talk and a lot more action to address it. And I do appreciate that it's more of a topic of conversation, which is good because it means there's awareness, heightened awareness to it. But I think for such a long time, and I don't know that this was necessarily by design. We've ended up in an environment in the industry, and I would argue in corporate culture overall, where there's very little representation of certain either racial groups or points of view or experiences and perspectives, you know? And I think all that is diversity. And it's really important to not have everyone in the room coming from the same perspective or the same background or the same experience. I think we don't live that way.
Yeah.
So it's weird that we would engineer settings that allow for only that perspective to be shared.
Especially if you're doing marketing or products or anything.
Exactly.
It's basically for all of marketing history been from the straight white male perspective. And that's like such a small makeup, you know, and it's definitely a minority makeup of this country. Well, and like, how do we get those other points of view in?
I think the demographics are shifting.
Yeah.
You know, it's undeniable. And you're going to have much more resonance and much more impact if you can speak authentically to different cultures. And if you can include or embed, you know, insights that that connect.
Yeah. And do you think has there anything that you've seen that's worked well as far as, you know, say more action and less talking about it? Like, you know, I think a lot of people want to make change, you know, and that's a thing we're working on as far as working out, Saturday morning is like, how do we grow the pipeline and get kids knowing that, you know, a career in the creative industry is an actual opportunity?
You know, I think we're doing some fun stuff together.
Yeah.
You know, I think through Futures, we're introducing people who wouldn't know that their passion for comic books or for drawing or for music could land them in a career where they're putting that to use every day, honing that talent, and really developing and contributing. I know I wasn't exposed to advertising really until I graduated and took that internship. And it's unfortunate because if I had known about it when I was in high school or even earlier on in college, it might have changed the nature of my entire career, you know? So I think we need more of those programs. I think Futures is awesome, and we need to push and make sure that we get that out there and get it recognized and get it connected to, you know, young talent just so they can come into the business. I think I'm involved with DNAD as well, and Shift is a program they have which does something quite similar.
Yeah,
we need more of that.
Well, I think, you know, even most of my friends didn't know you can make a career and make a living being an artist or creative or whatever, because those aren't the careers that are encouraged. And I think I've said this on the podcast before, is that like we're encouraged to go and, you know, get real jobs, you know, whether it's an accountant or a lawyer or a doctor. You know, and that you're not really encouraged to go to art school or to go and go to communication school, because those people don't know that those are opportunities. Mm-hmm. And so like the people up until this point that have done it have been kind of the freaks and geeks and weirdos. Mm-hmm. And the people who had the courage to go and pursue that, even though it wasn't encouraged for them.
Yeah.
And we need to go and let kids know, not even like, I think starting at college is too late. I think we need to go to elementary school and reach down and let these kids know that the thing that makes them unique and special is the thing that we need.
I'm 100% with you. And I think the education system sort of teaches the creativity out of you. Mm-hmm. And the earlier that we can intercept these kids and keep them creative and send them down the right path, the better products we're going to get, the more beautiful design we're going to get, the weirder music and art. Yeah.
And it's not that. Even, and I think also it's even beyond just creatives. It's like creative problem solving.
Exactly.
Like the world is changing so significantly. Like I was at a conference last year, and maybe misquoting the stat, but they said that right now 30% of the world's population lives in urban centers. Mm-hmm. And the next 15 to 20 years, it'll be 70%.
There you go.
And so we're going to have a whole host of problems. Mm-hmm. We need creative problem solving within science and within engineering and all that stuff. And it's like, we just need to like get more kids excited that these are real careers for them.
Yeah.
You know, and from all backgrounds, you know.
From all backgrounds. It's funny because I think 20 years ago, if you'd probably done a poll about what the most interesting or sort of lucrative career tracks were, you'd probably get something in the finance sort of looking space.
Yeah.
You know, like 5 years ago, probably tech.
Yeah.
I kind of feel like it's a little bit cyclical what people value as like the big kind of career track. 10 years from now, it might be AI. I mean, I don't know. I just think it's, you know, things evolve quickly, but I agree with you. Creative problem solving is always a constant. And if we can then get people inspired about using their creativity and applying it in lots of different contexts, we're going to continue to innovate and advance as a society, as a culture.
Yeah, for sure. I love talking about this stuff.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, and it gets exciting. And like, for me, I saw the guy from Alibaba. He was saying that, like, what was it, like 800 million jobs that currently exist are going to be automated in the next 12 years by 2030.
Yeah.
So that means kids in kindergarten right now are going to graduate into a world where, you know, there'll be new jobs, of course, that come up.
I think that's the key, and that's what people often forget. It's there will be new and different jobs.
Yeah.
And that's where putting some emphasis on, like, retraining people and helping us lean into emerging careers versus hang on to existing careers. I mean, it's just the way of the world. Like the only constant is change, right?
Yeah.
I feel like I hear that all the time. And I think us embracing more of that ethos is what's going to advance us as a species.
Yeah. Well, and you see the people holding on to old careers now, and it's like the coal industry. Why don't we have like that be the next Silicon Valley, and go to Appalachia and have it be, you know,
I mean,
Silicon Mountain or, you know, whatever it is, Silicon Trail, and go and like teach all of those coal miners coding.
I think we've done a really bad job of making people feel like they can walk away from some of those jobs that are starting to disappear.
Mm-hmm.
Because
psychologically,
I get it. Yeah. You know, if you told me tomorrow that I could no longer work in advertising, I would probably have some issues with that.
Yeah.
But you've got to help me see that there is a future, mm-hmm. and that future is bright and exciting. And something
and
that
you're a part of it.
Is achievable, and that I'm part of it. Exactly. And I think that's kind of where we went wrong in the narrative with a lot of people in this country.
Yeah. And people, I think, feel forgotten. And,
exactly.
Yeah. And it's like, hey, no, like you can do this. You can evolve. You can do it. Yeah. And give them some excitement around mm-hmm. it and actually hope, which goes along.
Everyone wants to feel hopeful about their future. Like no one wants to think that their future is going to be worse than the past.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
You know, and from what I read, you know, talking about diversity and different points of views and perspectives, you know, Chobani seems to be at the forefront of having a pretty diverse workplace. So mm-hmm. I saw a story about Hamdi hiring refugees, mm-hmm. and I love the quote. He's just like, yeah, as soon as you give them a job, they're not a refugee anymore. Yep. Shockingly, he got backlash for that. But do you see, like, what is Chobani doing right beyond just that, that maybe other places could learn from?
I just think Chobani values a culture where lots of different points of views can thrive. And we engineer our spaces, we engineer our teams, and we pay a lot of attention to how we can make people from lots of different contexts feel truly comfortable bringing their authentic selves to work.
Yeah.
And in some instances, that means we have to do things in multiple languages. In some instances, that means we need to provide transportation. In some instances, that means mm-hmm. we need to provide, you know, food. I just think if it matters to you, you figure out a way to make it a core part of what you do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you prioritize it.
Exactly.
That's pretty great. Yeah. Putting people first goes a long way.
It's super simple.
Yeah.
It's very basic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I have some questions now. We have a few minutes left. Hold on. So these are a little bit more personal.
Okay.
Do you feel like you have something to prove?
Every single day. And this might have been beaten into me by my dad. I mean, I grew up in an African household, and if anyone knows anything about African households, it's that it's never good enough. And that sounds more horrible than it actually was. Yeah. I just think my parents always pushed us to overachieve, mm-hmm. and that was their way of helping us understand that the world's not going to do you any favors.
Yeah.
And if you want something in life, you have to work very, very, very hard for it.
Yeah.
And you can't ever stop, you know? And I think not that, you know, perfection is a goal, but it's important for you to keep working hard until you feel you've achieved like mastery.
Right.
Yeah.
Do you feel like though your ambition ever gets in the way of your happiness?
That's a really good question. I don't think so. Mm-hmm. I tend to have a pretty healthy balance. My wife's probably rolling her eyes right now. I try to have a healthy balance, and yeah. when I don't, she helps me get that perspective.
Yeah, that's nice.
So yeah,
keep you in check.
Yeah, I just feel like she's very good at that. I'm not. You know, ultimately, it's easy to over-index on something when you truly care about it. And I feel I am doing stuff every day that I'm very passionate about. So it's yeah. very easy for me to get there.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, you gotta put your head up and smell the roses sometimes. And I think it's good to have people around you that can help you do that.
Yeah, I think yeah. That's one of the things I realized. Having people around to keep you in check and remind you of that.
Yeah.
Because I think it's easy to just put blinders on. And
yes.
You feel like, hey, I'm running towards that goal. And
yeah.
It's like, well, what the hell happened in the last year or 5 years? And that sucks. That if there's any, like, I don't regret a lot of things, but I regret, like, taking people and time and experiences and moments for granted.
I'm nodding, and I totally agree with that. And I remember one moment specifically when I was supposed to go to a friend's wedding, and I was working you know, at an agency on a very important project, and mm-hmm. I ended up working so late that there was no possible way for me to get to that wedding, and it was out of town. I had to catch a bunch of flights, blah blah blah.
Yeah.
And you know, I didn't make the wedding, and I think it definitely affected the friendship I had in a not positive way. And to this day, I always go back to that moment. I'm like, you know what? There's some things in life that you have to prioritize and keep in context.
Yeah.
You know?
And it's easy to keep that mindset that's kind of forced into us that you need to work, keep working, keep working.
Oh, absolutely.
And like, this is the most important thing ever.
Absolutely.
Like,
absolutely.
Now, like that beer commercial is still going to get out regardless.
It's funny you say beer. Anyway.
Yeah. what's been the most challenging point in your career?
Oof. I thought these were meant to be softball questions, man.
No, man, this is overshare. This is where it gets real.
So, I would say the most challenging point in my career was a few years ago when I was essentially hired to start and build a team at an agency. Mm-hmm. And looking back now, I realized that I might have been possibly a bit too young to have that role. Mm-hmm. You know, I think I didn't have the soft skills to navigate the culture and the personalities, and you know, this is where I think having a bit of gray hair helps.
Yeah.
A lot of what you do, especially in leadership and in management, is not as obvious. You know, of course you have your skill sets that you're applying to make the output or your craft in terms of what you're making.
Yeah.
But a lot of it is navigating the people and the situations and the conflict. And I think having experience in that area, having the confidence, having the maturity helps you successfully work through a lot of that stuff that is, you know, a little bit harder to see. So, I think that was a challenging point. I was hired to build this team. I didn't quite have those skills developed yet, and I think I really struggled to advocate for what I needed for the success of that team and for the success of the people. And I left that experience, to be quite honest, feeling like a failure.
Yeah.
Like a massive failure.
Yeah, well, and I feel like as creative people and we do these jobs and then you get promoted because, or you keep moving up and striving to move up because you feel like, well, that's the next step.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a completely different set of skills.
Yeah.
That nobody really teaches you, and you need to have mentors that can go and teach you that, and you have to go and like, you know, be hungry enough to and curious enough to learn about that stuff. That's like the hardest part of my job now.
Yeah.
It's like, I didn't know how to do any of this shit. And it's like, oh, people, and they have needs and wants and personalities, and that's harder than any business decision. It's just like, how do you make sure that people feel supported and feel like they can do the things they need to do?
Yeah. I mean, I totally agree. And I think people trust you and put their confidence in you, and you don't want to let them down, mm-hmm. but you aren't quite sure how to navigate. And I think that's where having a network, having people that you can reach out to who've been in a similar position to just get advice or get perspective from, and also just having the confidence to admit when you're not sure or you don't know or you're not well equipped to navigate something. I think that's all okay.
Yeah, because just blind confidence is just like, it gets you in trouble.
I mean, that gets you in trouble.
Yeah. What's been your proudest moment?
Ooh. So my proudest moment is actually right after that failure that I described. Yeah. I took some time off. I traveled. Just needed to sort of reset and just figure out what was important to me. And then when I came back, I started a creative collective. This might have been when we first met, maybe, I'm not sure. But I started a creative collective that called Small Giants. And I would freelance a bunch of friends, and we'd partner with brands and other agencies to work on projects.
Yeah.
And I think the thing I'm proudest of is one of those projects. I worked with a fantastic creative director called Koichiro Tanaka. He had a company called Projector. And we worked on a few projects for Uniqlo together.
Mm-hmm.
One of those projects.
That was super cool, yeah.
Yeah, it was, honestly, I was super proud of it just because we were a super small team. We worked very nimbly, incredibly collaboratively. We built an app called Uniqlo Recipe. We worked with six emerging chefs from around the country, brought them together, had them create recipes for breakfast, lunch, dinner, and dessert. Baked it all into this incredible iPad and iPhone sort of recipe app,
mm-hmm.
And launched it to a lot of fanfare and success. And I think I'm proud of it because with a team that was probably a tenth the size of a team at an agency,
yeah,
we built this incredible product experience. that did so well that Apple voted it as one of the best apps of the year in the App Store. And, you know, we picked up some medal at one show and a bunch of other shows. I was proud of it because I didn't think that was possible, if I'm completely honest.
And
it
with
was
such nice a small team.
With such a small team. Yeah. And it was nice to pull it together.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
What do you want to do that you haven't done yet?
How much time you got?
Yeah.
It's a long list, my friend.
We got like 4 minutes.
4 minutes? I want to be the very best version of myself. And that is something that I aspire to every day. And I don't know that I will ever achieve it, or I hope not to achieve it, because I like to think that I have limitless potential. But yeah, I think every day is a grind. Every day is a hustle. Just if you can do one thing better every day, to me, you're on the right track.
Yeah. What's your Achilles heel as a creative person?
Ooh, it's a very good question. I think I honestly believe there are very few things that are impossible. And I say it's an Achilles heel because it sometimes pushes you to take on things that you probably shouldn't take on. And
like a job that you're taking on for.
Like that.
Yeah.
But I also feel if you're not pushing your limits, if you're not failing, then you're not achieving your potential.
Yeah. And then you're safe.
Exactly. You're in a very safe space, and I think there's something about you that is dying every day if you stay in a space where you're completely safe.
Yeah.
You gotta get outside the lines. Yeah. You know, just you have to embrace this idea that you're gonna feel insecure and unsure, and you're gonna feel nervous and probably a bit worried, but be confident. Make sure that you surround yourself with good people that can help support and protect for the areas that you're not as strong. And stay curious, because that's how you're going to continue to learn, you know. And there are very few things that aren't just a Google away.
Yeah.
You know, and I think if you have the curiosity and if you want to lean in and learn, there's nothing you can't do.
Yeah, it's so good. Great advice. What is success to you?
Success. Success to me is relative. You know, I think everyone defines their own success.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's a singular thing. It's not money. It's not happiness. I think it's important for you to define that for yourself. Yeah. You know, and I think for me, it goes back to what I said before. It's waking up every day and feeling like I am a better person, you know, manager, friend, partner. It's incremental improvement in all those areas.
Yeah. Because if you can make incremental improvement every day.
Exactly.
Then you're definitely in the right.
Yeah. It's like that 401k, that 401k thing, right?
Yeah.
Like the younger you invest sort of thing, like the more,
Just investing in yourself.
What is it? Compounding returns. Yeah.
Compounding returns and not being a piece of shit. Yeah.
That too.
Are you happy?
Yeah. I can't remember who. I took a trip to Philly this weekend to see my roommate from college. He just had his second kid. And you know, we've stayed in touch. I don't see him that often. I'm also not advocating for you, you know, evaluating your happiness through other people's perceptions.
Yeah.
But it was really nice to see him and to have him say to me, man, I feel like you're in an incredibly creative space and you feel happy and sort of fulfilled, you know? And I said, oh, I guess maybe I am.
Uh-huh. It helped have him identify it.
Yeah.
What you were exuding.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And I think, you know, your energy says a lot about that. I think I'm happy that I'm doing the things that I want to do with my life.
Yeah.
And I think it's important for everyone to embrace that. Like, you're designing your own adventure. And if you're not, someone else is designing it for you.
Yeah. That's a great way to put it.
Yeah.
Finally, how are you feeling right now?
I'm feeling a little cold, to be honest. The AC in here is insane. But guy, this was dope. It's good to catch up. I feel like, amazing. You know, we see each other in passing now, and it's always in moments, but it's good to sit down and have a conversation.
This has been really nice.
Yeah. So
thanks, man.
No, it's been a pleasure.
We did it.
Cool. All right.
Kwame, thanks for joining me. It was great catching up, man. If you enjoyed this Overshare, please subscribe to ensure you get our future episodes when they're released every 2 weeks. Also, rate and review us to help other people discover Overshare. Thanks to the team at Second Child for hosting us in their beautiful studio in Droga 5 in downtown New York City. Thanks to our audio engineer, Jesse Peterson, to Gabby D'Amato for editing this episode, and to Alex Cantel for helping me record this VO. The Overshare theme song is Let It Grow by Caleb Grow. Follow us on our brand new Overshare Instagram and Twitter channels at Overshare Talks to find more content and info about our live events. And we also have a private Facebook group at Overshare Talks as well. And if you'd like to learn more about Working Not Working and join as a creative or to hire creatives, check us out at workingnotworking.com.